You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
I'm Ben Brantley, and this is The Fabulous Invalid.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, Broadway's podcast, where we present essential conversations with a curated roster of the best, most important, and innovative theater makers working today, from actors to writers, directors, designers, and everyone in between. We took our name from the title of the 1938 play by Kaufman and Hart that has since become a loving nickname for Broadway itself. Always deemed on the verge of decline, yet always bouncing back, The Fabulous Invalid. I'm theater savant Jamie Dumont.
And I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with Stage Left at NYC.
Hi, Rob Russo.
Hi, Jamie.
How are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
I'm very, very well.
Well, I'm excited for today's guest because if I can share with our listeners.
Share.
Ben Brantley is someone who we have wanted on the show from day one, right? From before we even
recorded.
We were like, dream list. He's the guest we want. And we got him.
We did. In the truth of the matter is,
yes.
We got him right away.
That's true.
And we had a different idea of what we wanted that show to be. And then for a variety of reasons, it didn't come to fruition. And Ben was very gracious about saying, I will come on. And we finally made it happen.
Yes. And, you know, while he's not a theater maker per se, it's hard to argue with the idea that he is one of the most influential and important people in the theater. Large.
And why is that, Rob?
Oh, well, Jamie, I thought you'd never ask. If you don't know, somehow, if you live under a rock.
If you don't live in this world.
Ben Brantley is the co-chief theater critic for the New York Times, where he's been on staff since 1993 and became the chief in 1996. Which is a remarkably long time to be at the helm of that division of arts criticism.
Longest ever,
for
right?
For the paper of record. I'm not sure if it's the longest ever, but it certainly must. It's the longest in modern, you know, history. Right? I don't know. I mean, I don't know how long Brooks Atkinson was writing for the Times.
I don't think that. Well, we'll have to find out.
We'll have to look.
Tweet
into
at
it.
Us if
yeah.
you know.
Yeah. But before coming to the Times, you might not know that Ben was a staff writer for the New Yorker and Vanity Fair. He reviewed fashion for Women's Wear Daily, where he was the Paris bureau chief and European editor, and he reviewed movies for Elle magazine. He's originally from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And graduated from Swarthmore College. And over the course of his career, he has edited two books of New York Times theater reviews. I have one of them. I need to get the other one.
I'm shocked you don't have them both.
I know. I'm going to go
home. I'm shocked they're not sitting
right
on the table.
After this. I know. I should have brought it to have them sign. He's edited those books and reviews. And he's also the recipient of the prestigious George Jean Nathan Award for Theater Criticism. So we have with us today one of the most celebrated writers about the theater probably ever. You know,
he's
on that list of, you know, Walter Kerr, Brooks Atkinson, Ben Brantley.
And I think he's a man that people don't know a lot about.
Yes.
So I'm excited to talk to him.
Yeah, me too. Should we do it?
Let's do it. Hi, Ben. Thanks for coming down and joining us.
I'm happy to.
You've worked at several publications before coming to the Times.
Oh, yes.
And in different capacities.
Mm-hmm,
so
very,
I'm curious to start us off, if you could share with us how you came to be a theater critic for the Times.
Well, it was a very circuitous road. I'd worked for the Village Voice when I took a semester off when I was in college at Swarthmore. But that was just basically, you know, an intern position. And the first job I had out of college was at Women's Wear Daily, NW. And I covered fashion for them and out of New York and Paris. It was a great job to have in your early 20s. I mean, it was like sort of a Sybarites graduate school. But you learned a lot too, and you learned to look at things very quickly. And in any case, through all this, yes, I'd always loved theater, et cetera, et cetera. I grew up with it. There was a great theater program at the university where my dad worked. And I studied acting. I did like local commercials and so forth. And in college, I realized I had a I was a much better writer than I was an actor. And also I come from a family of journalists, so that was sort of the path of least resistance. First interview I ever had with John after college was with John Fairchild, then the publisher of Women's Wear Daily. And he said, if you could have any job in the world, what would it be? And I said, theater critic of the New York Times. That was many years ago. I don't think either of us thought it was quite very likely to come true. But so Women's Wear, I was there for 7 years. I ended as the Paris editor and publisher. I quit because I thought my life should perhaps take a different direction. It was probably the bravest thing I ever did. But I did. I walked out without another job, but soon found work at under contract Tina Brown, first for Condé Nast, first for the Vanity Fair. And then she took me with her to the New Yorker. At the same time, I was doing on the side movie reviews for Elle magazine. My first editor there was a woman named Alex Witchell, who was going out with a guy named Frank Rich. And when they were looking for a new second string theater critic, this was some time after she'd left the magazine, she said, maybe we should ask Ben Brantley. So Frank called and said, do you want to audition for this? And I said, oh yeah, right. And then it happened very quickly. And that was 27 years
yes,
ago.
Yes, you've been there ever since. Wow. And then you became the chief in 1996.
Yes. The best part was the first 2 years. Yeah. That was heaven.
Why was that the best part?
Because, you know, I mean, once you got over that initial hump of what people's expectations or prejudices might be, you got to see so much fresher stuff. It wasn't stuff that had been processed, you know, by 1,000 producers and, you know, massaged into shape and glossed up. And there it was, and I loved going into a hole in a wall and seeing someone like Richard Maxwell for the first time. That was, you all know who he is, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that was the thrilling moment. I love doing this now, but, it's been fun being a chief critic, but, and it means I get to go to London often, which is nice too. But everything that's opening on Broadway this season, I've already seen.
Exactly. Right. I feel the same way. I took a couple trips last year, and I'm like, well, I guess I can save my pennies. You know, I've already seen everything.
Well, there's one or two shows, perhaps, that will be new to you. How many shows a year do you see?
I don't know. When I'm in New York, probably 4 or 5 a week in high season, maybe 3 on an average in slower times. When I'm in London, I'll do as many as 10 a week because they stagger the matinees.
Yeah. It's easy to do that. It's easier to do that there than here.
It is because of the way things are scheduled. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's nice. So this is sort of the big question, but why do you write about the theater?
Although I sort of glossed over it earlier, theater was really the first thing I fell in love with. It's been an obsession of mine since I was pretty much since I could talk, certainly since I could read. My granddad taught Shakespeare. My most natural predilection is for like writing papers for English classes, but you can't make a living doing that all your life. And this sort of is translating that particular skill that I honed really all through my life, along with my journalism background. I was also writing for papers since I was like 10 or something, because my mother was on the afternoon paper, and I interned there. I covered the Miss North Carolina pageant. And theater was the constant, though, theater and books. When I was in Paris, I'd get to London as often as I could. I didn't actually familiarize myself, as I should have, with the French theater, but I wanted to escape every weekend, and I went to London. So I saw a lot then. And it's so gratifying to write about, in a way. I mean, movies... I love movies, and obviously they affect you when you're watching them in a very visceral way often. But with theater, it's just so much more intense because it is living people, and it could all go so wrong in a second or, you know, just soar into the heavens in a second, too. That's why I haven't gotten bored. I still find it exciting. Even when I don't like something, you're trying to figure out why you don't like something and where is the energy sort of misplaced. It makes you into a great observer generally. And if I could write about anything, it wouldn't be books. It wouldn't be film. And also so much of film is seen on tiny screens now too. So I don't think it's quite the same communal experience. Theater is also one of the last, you know, great gathering places for, I was starting to say for many sorts of people, but for many sorts of people with solid bank accounts.
Right. Who can't afford it. Right.
I also think only a theater person or a lover of theater would flee Paris for London for a few days. There's no other reason to leave Paris.
There you go.
Is there a major difference between writing for film, writing about film and writing about theater?
Well, when I was writing about film, it was for Elle magazine. It was... I had 350 words, 400 words. Maybe, I think once I wrote 500 on Miller's Crossing.
Just nothing, really.
Not by time standards.
Right.
And I was used, of course, to the more long-form piece. We were given thousands of words at Vanity Fair. And it was kind of like doing haiku. You know? You really had to boil it down.
Yes.
When I came to the Times, I was allowed to expatiate more. I could describe, you know, plots, name characters. I mean, you really were doing sort of Morse code when it was shorter, but that was very good training too. Mm.
So when you're writing review, who are you writing for?
I like to think of myself as kind of a window, ideally. I mean, obviously there's some frame, there's the lattice work, which is your perspective and what you bring to it. But ideally, I'm trying to create for people who either think or thinking about seeing this, but also people who will never get a chance to see what I'm writing about. I'm trying to recreate the experience of what it was like for this person to watch that at this moment in time, to make it as much of a sensory experience as I can. Mm. Through words.
So it's almost like obviously they're historical documents because they're in print and you're writing for the paper of record, but that's also your perspective when you're writing these reviews, as if it's for somebody who's not going to see it.
Yes.
But also to keep it as a living piece of history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I really enjoy sports writing too. I mean, I don't really enjoy watching sports mostly, but I do enjoy sports writing.
Why is that?
It's because of the passion of it. And I think it's really analogous to theater criticism. I was editing a book of Times reviews some years ago, and you have people, you know, Brooks Atkinson or later Clive Barnes or Walter Kerr, especially in the early days when you've also got like Alexander Wolcott. It's, oh my God, did you just hear what happened last night? Theater will never be the same. It's like, you know, holy cow, he's hit a homer again. There was a real kind of, I was there, a witness to this great excitement. Mm. And I think it's harder for theater criticism to be like that now because, for social media, for one thing. So as soon as a show is in previews, and sometimes even before, people start posting things about it, and it kind of dilutes the climate.
Do you try to block all that out?
Do I try? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, before I go into a show. Also, I mean, who's posting this stuff anyway? Do you know? You have to be a little suspicious. No, I learned long ago that none of that stuff can be taken at face value. And I don't spend a lot of time, I don't spend any time in chat rooms, tweets. Even though I don't tweet myself, I had to be on Twitter because someone was impersonating me. And the only way you can get your name back is to post it, is to be yourself as yourself. So occasionally I get tweets bounced towards me on subjects that it's kind of hard to ignore.
Well, you've just talked about the nature of observation and mm-hmm. how, you know, essential that is to theater criticism, to writing about the theater. One of the things that strikes me about your writing as a fan of your work and as a consumer of it is the way that you capture a performance and describe an actor's performance. How did you develop those skills? Is it purely from doing, you know, fashion and film before, or...
No, I mean, I did act for many years as a kid. I wasn't good. I mean, I was a really good kid actor because I don't think that's true now, but I think at that time, no one expected children to be authentic. Mm. They sort of impersonated an idea of what a child should be. Right. And I was pretty good at that. As I got older, I realized that acting required a certain nakedness in public that I wasn't willing to present. And I don't mean taking your clothes off, obviously.
Right.
I mean emotional self-exposure. I think it's really brave when they do that and when they do it really well. I mean, someone like Mary Louise Parker. I mean, it's extraordinary that she can pull that off every night. But anyway, having studied acting, I think anyone who's studied acting or has been on stage at all, you do recognize when people are coasting. especially true with Shakespeare. Oh, what a rogue and peasant. I mean, then you just land on certain words, you know, and you make your tones plummier. But then you think, they don't know what they're saying sometimes. And there are people who get by on charm, I think you're aware. When all the muscles are working, though, that's really exciting. Mm. And you see it on screen, too, but it's a very different thing because the level of projection is so different. I don't know if you saw the Richard Nelson production of Uncle Vanya at Hunter.
No,
did you see that?
It.
I did not.
Oh, yeah. That was so beautiful. But that, I mean, what he's done, I mean, you've probably seen, if you've seen any of the like Rhinebeck plays, the Apple plays or whatever, mm-hmm. he's devised a system of tiny microphones. They would be coming down at us like this, like little tiny chandeliers, and they pick up everything. So if you're doing Chekhov and you don't want to be screaming, you want to say, you know, Sonia, I'm not the person that I was. I do not know why I feel this way. If you want to say it in that sotto voce, it's really, really exciting. So that kind of blurs the boundaries a little bit, except that it's still live. And when you get that kind of intimacy, when you're that close, I mean, with real people, Chekhov lives.
Just have to take a second and let that sit in the room because that's well said. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about your writing process.
Because I worked as a daily journalist for so many years, I always loved words and I always would like give titles to things in my mind or, you know, extravagant names to ordinary people as I was growing up. So I was always applying words to things. So when I started doing journalism, it became very naturally for me to think of leads very quickly. I remember when I was an intern at a paper in Winston-Salem, all that summer I was thinking, I was turning like, he brushed his teeth. He brushed his teeth that morning, little knowing that. I mean, it was just everything automatically turned into journalese. So I still have that to a certain extent. So when I'm watching, I will have a tentative lead in my head by the end of the first act, and then the second act may surprise me, or something else may seem incredibly important, or it wasn't as good as I thought it was going to be. It may displace it, but usually I write the next morning. I never just go home and write. I might write down a few notes, and I'll write it the next day. If I have time, if I have the luxury of a couple of days, I like to write something and come back to it. More often, I'll just write it and send it in. And we're sort of like, reviews are kind of like, you know, baling hay as far as, you know, the people at the Times are concerned. You know, so, oh, here's another one, get it on the truck, send it out. It's because, you know, there's just so much copy coming in, and there are fewer editors now than there were before than ever in terms of actually, you know, hands-on editing. So it's tough for them. So that's why I often send it in early so they can... have it if they have a spare moment in there.
Well, I've sat behind you or around you before at the theater, and I noticed that you never take your eyes off the stage. And I don't know if that's an intentional thing or if it's just because you're so invested in what's going on, which also means that as you're taking notes, you don't seem to be looking at your notebook. Is that a skill that you've developed?
No. I wish it were. I could write just for you now. I could write, you know, the first line of the Constitution, and you wouldn't be able to read it. When I'm taking notes, it's ridiculous. I'll occasionally star something and write something in big capital letters like death, you know. But basically, it's just when there's some sort of motor connection going on, or perceptual thing, where when you write something down, it's almost like you tattoo it. into your memory. So whether you actually can see what you were saying in notes afterwards. When I was first in the job, I would type up my notes every morning, and I would have researched the thing for like, you know, 3 afternoons at the Library of Performing Arts. But if I were still doing that, I would probably not be alive.
How does the decision get made as to which critic reviews what shows, and do you have any say in that process?
Oh yeah, no, Jesse and I we should be doing it actually like today or tomorrow. We either meet for lunch, or if our schedules don't allow, we just we talk on the phone for like an hour. It's a fun conversation, and we're fairly deferential about who gets to do what. I mean, I knew, for example, last season, I said, all right, I'll be doing The Ferryman because I saw it in London, which means you have to do To Kill a Mockingbird because those were the two plays of heft. Although only one was nominated for Tony Award, go figure. But
we're still talking about that.
Yes.
So when you see shows in London, does that and they come in, which they frequently do, right. as
or
we said earlier,
Broadway, and then yeah, they move to Broadway. Yeah.
So you typically want to re-review those
Usually,
shows.
Usually, I mean, if you've especially if you've given it a really positive review, you know, I mean, what if Jesse saw it and went, ugh? I mean, it's which you know you don't. It's. I don't rule out the possibility of our changing as well. Oh, for example, when Freestyle Love Supreme moved to Broadway, Jesse had done it off Broadway, but he had another Broadway opening that week, so I took it. And I think it was safe to say that you know who wouldn't respond to that you know with an open heart really. I let him do. I didn't let him. I told him he should do Tina, which I had done in London because I had the feeling that our takes would be fundamentally the same.
Hmm. That's interesting, though. Do you ever consider that your takes will be different when you talk about who's going to review what show in terms of...
Oh, yes. I mean, it's not something... to some extent, I think you know that, you know, and we have our definite predispositions and fondnesses. And if it's a writer that one of us has championed for a long time trying something new, I think it should be the champion who writes the piece. Hmm. But
that's interesting. I don't think a lot of people would think that or
right.
know that.
Right.
That's actually really interesting. This is sort of beside the point, but I'm just curious. Can you predict what other critics might think about something based on what you know about the way they review?
No. I think people are so surprising generally. It's and you know, I kind of love that. Can you believe she liked that? You know, it's I mean, we're all so passionate and personal about it, but it is just one person's opinion. Hmm. And when you read accounts of how a play was received years later, if you were there, or even if it were many decades ago, and you actually read the initial reviews, it's not always represented as it was written. It's like this kind of aura of opinion seems to float from the way it's recalled. Oh, it was a disaster. No one liked it. And then you look up and say, well, you know, actually, I don't know. I mean, was Good Vibrations as bad as we thought it was then?
Maybe. Yes. Yes, it was. But interestingly enough, and I actually just said this when we recorded a few days ago, I, for a variety of reasons, went back and read the original reviews of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Yeah.
They're not particularly good.
No.
Which is, I was so surprised. So you're right. You never, like, we forget. Time sort of.
And it shakes out. You know, and of course, now when anyone writes about, you know, whatever it was, 63, 64, the year that Virginia Woolf blasted Broadway. You know? I'm still shaking.
Right. Well, you know, a publicist wrote that.
Exactly. Well, it's interesting because, you know, you're obviously aware, as we all are, that the Times occupies a very special place in the world of theater criticism and journalism. There are some, you know, in the industry who, you know, are professionals who sometimes lament, I'll use the word lament, the power that they believe the Times might have in terms of shaping the box office, but also influencing the tone of how a particular show might be perceived. How do you respond to that critique as, you know, one of the people who was writing the reviews?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see it as a critique so much as a statement of a fact of life. And you can't win in this argument. People will say, oh, it's such a shame. The Times doesn't have its power anymore. And then, oh, no, the Times is too powerful. And they cancel each other out as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And the only way, and from the very beginning, you put on blinders. You try to describe as accurately and entertainingly as possible what you saw the night before or a couple of nights ago. Mm-hmm. But... I think I would have had a breakdown if I every morning go, oh my God,
right.
Where am I? What am I doing? No, I don't feel too existentially challenged in that way. I think most people, when they do their jobs, just do their jobs.
Right.
I mean, unless you're a plutocrat.
Okay, so on that note, continuing that thought, what is harder to write? A rave, a pan, a mixed review?
The reviews I'm proudest of are generally mixed reviews. Raves are the easiest to write. I mean, unless it's sort of an esoteric person or a group that you're trying to explain to people who might not normally venture into those, you know, surreal precincts. But generally, a rave is just, oh, you feel so good doing it because you are enthusiastic. I mean, if you really feel it, I mean, I think faking it is not a good idea. I think you can always tell when a critic's faking it. And they're easy in another way because it's so easy to score all things. But I think you really have to think about why you think something doesn't work and then give, I mean, the fun part of a pan for me is giving the physical feeling that, well, not even a pan, a rave too, any kind of play, because plays do operate on you physically because they're live and there's an exchange of energy going on between the audience and the performers. And it's kind of fun. I mean, you can feel when you don't like something, and it does have, you know, you might have been kicked in the stomach, you might have been just drained of your blood with all the vampires, and there were so many bad vampire musicals all at once.
Yes.
So, I mean, that aspect of it is fun. The reviews I'm proudest of are probably the mixed ones where you actually said, this is interesting for this reason, it doesn't work for this reason, but it has something, because it's harder to achieve that balance. And you also know readers don't want to read mixed reviews. We're a thumbs up, thumbs down culture. Did you love it? Did you hate it? Right. I mean, it has to be one or the other. And if we're absolutely honest with ourselves, we don't ever respond unconditionally to anything. Mm. All emotions are mixed by nature. I mean, that's just the way it is. But anyway, so you're lying to some extent when you say perfection was reached, of course, you're, but I mean, it's hype. Everything is hyperbole. It's always a broader statement of what you feel than what you might have really felt. I think very, very few writers, and I don't think any writers in journalism have that kind of crystalline quality of getting down to that core of ambivalence and everything. And no one wants to hear about it. We want clear signals.
Right, right. So do you ever experience when you're writing a review that the idea that you have about the show, as you're expressing it, might actually change? You know, you thought you loved it, or you thought you had a certain reaction, but actually it turns out on further thought, well, maybe no, maybe it was a little forced, or it was
I mean, it usually I wind up going back to my initial response, because that's what you got to go with is the gut of what you were seeing when you were watching it. But then, you know, you may think, I probably didn't think it was that funny. And then, but then I've seen scripts where I'm just going, ah! I mean, like every other page.
Right.
And obviously I'm remembering how the performers said them. So it's, and then I'll think, no, it was as good as I thought it was.
Yeah. Well, you said, I was doing a little research and I found something that you had said about how you judge new works in particular. I'm going to read this. You judge new works based on what they aspire to do and how they adhere to their own aspirations and follow through with clarity and accessibility. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. I mean, what you're most looking for with a new play is an original voice. It's not so much tell me something new as show me something new or something old even, but from a perspective I haven't seen before. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, that's really exciting. And I think it's been happening a fair amount in recent years. Jackie Sibley's Drury, I mean, I just think that's and she changes with each play the way Carol Churchill does. So I think that's exciting. I think one of the hardest things to do in theater, because there are so many moving parts, live moving parts, is creating a production in which everyone is on the same page and it's a self-contained universe that abides by its own rules. And obviously the play has to create a consistent reality to begin with, although some directors can make you believe that the playwright has done that when she or he hasn't necessarily. But it's very exciting when you see a first play or a play from a writer you hadn't known much of before, and you just go, wow. I mean, it's just... the first time I saw Richard Maxwell, I felt that. I mean, just this kind of incredible deadpan stuff. And I was going, how pretentious is this? And then you just keep watching. You go, this is so moving. I mean, this is really, really smart. And And that's the other thing with new. I think when it's new and really good, radical, I think you're not going to know at first what to feel. And I think that's probably a good sign. Thomas Bradshaw, do you know his work?
No, I don't.
Do I have the name right? Bradshaw, yeah. He does the sort of uncensored mixed race. He did the one about pornography, the one about Job.
No, I don't know.
Yeah, we need to look into this.
Do some research, I know. Yeah.
But he writes, I mean, really uncensored. It's like, you know, we all kind of prettify whatever we say. And with him, it's like it's straight from the id. It's the worst things you think. Oh, God. I mean, like the Nazi brother and sister in the bathtub. But it's very much his own vision. And, you know, you can throw this stuff out just to shock, and some people do, and sometimes it seems really gratuitous. Like, you know, nudity and Noel Coward. But there are, when something truly shocks, I think that means that's good. It's not too easy to be shocked right now.
But it sounds like what you're talking about, there's a truth in what's shocking. Mm-hmm. It's not gratuitous, as you said.
Exactly.
It's honest, which is a big difference.
No, and by shock, I guess I don't mean, you know, I was starting to say eating babies, but then I thought Blasted's a really great play. But for other reasons, Sarah Kane was one of the most shocking playwrights ever to emerge. I mean, the way Ibsen must have been perceived, or was perceived at the end of the 19th century. But that's because it's questioning assumptions and questioning things that make you comfortable. I think Edward Albee in the early days did that too, very much so. And that case, I don't think it's shocking for shocking's sake. No, shocking's for shocking's sake is, I mean, that's what a lot of the 60s movies were, I think, too. That you look back on them, you go, oh, no, it's just, nah, you know, thumbing your nose or, you know, pulling down your pants.
Right, and they don't hold up in the same way.
No. Yeah.
Well, when thinking about new work in particular, because you have a deadline and you have to write something in a relatively short amount of time, do you ever have the experience of writing a review about something and then the play stays with you and you keep thinking about it, or you even revisit it maybe a month or a year later, and you find that what you initially wrote doesn't tell the full story of how you feel about it.
Yeah, or, I mean, but I also think it's how you feel about it on those different occasions too. It's what are you bringing to it that night that you see. I mean, I never, if I look back on what I wrote, I don't ever think, oh, that wasn't what I was feeling. If it was what I was feeling, I feel I did a decent job. But the great thing about theater is that it is chemistry. I mean, you could have a second date that just works, even though it's the same people involved.
That's right.
In a way, it didn't the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some argument that for critics seeing something more than once, but I'm not sure that's fair either. Because again, one of the joys of theater is that it's sort of a singular experience. But yeah, and also, I mean, for example, the musical Once. When I saw it at New York Theater Workshop, I thought the music was lovely. And I thought what Stephen Hoggett did with the staging with John Tiffany was quite beautiful. But I didn't love the book. It was Enda Walsh, a playwright I really like, who does much more sort of outre things most of the time. And he's also done one for the one that's coming in now.
Sing Street.
Right, Sing Street. And when I saw Once, I liked it. I thought that it was a little precious, especially up close. When I saw it on Broadway, I thought, you know, it really benefits from the distance because those are very striking images. And I bought Kristen Milioti's character much more. This little, oh, so you like my vacuum cleaner. I mean, once you kind of get past that. Do you think she'd be allowed to be cast today?
Oh, that's interesting.
That's a good question. Yeah. Probably not.
No, I guess
probably
not.
Probably not.
Yeah. And that wasn't that long ago. Yeah, things happened very quickly.
That was not even a decade ago, was it?
No.
It's like 8 years ago?
No. Yeah.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
One thing that I think is incredibly hard to write about is direction. And I wonder if you could share for us a little bit about how you go about assessing a director's work, because it's one thing that's literally not on the stage, mm-hmm. right? Is what a director does in
yeah, I mean, there are the auteurs, sure. which you tend to find more in experimental theater. Mm-hmm. And when you're seeing something like Richard Foreman, who's not working anymore, but when I was covering his stuff early on, I mean, that is a director's vision. That's a very specific vision. What you get with Elizabeth LeCompte, and even though it's a collaboration, the Worcester Group, it's a very, very specific vision, mm-hmm. as specific as, you know, a Scorsese or a... and any number of other David Lynch distinctive mm-hmm. directors. You know, you're more aware of directing when it's bad than when it's good, unless it's a director, unless it's something like, you know, a revamped An Inspector Calls, where it's just, whoa, who thought right. to do that? You know, or Eva von Hove, obviously, you have to talk about the directing because that's very much, he's reshaping the world in a very particular image of his own. Otherwise, I mean, some of the best are seamless. I mean, Joe Mantello is generally a seamless director who doesn't call a whole lot of attention to what he's doing. And in that case, you don't know what choices he steered the cast towards, for example. Mm. So you can't really say, sometimes I think I say, you know, the director, she or he uses the cast in a certain way, or seems to show the compassion of the writer or something like that. But unless you're, you know, in the room when it happens, you don't know exactly right. what has been achieved. There are often directorial visions, especially with Shakespeare, mm-hmm. Where everyone feels like they sort of have to have their own imprimatur.
You mentioned earlier, and I know Jamie was struck by it, the idea of a critic as a champion
yeah.
of a certain artist or a certain
right.
work.
Now, I may have misspoken in that sense. I see what you mean. I mean, I would have said 20 years ago that I was a champion of David Mamet, but in that sense, only that I really, really admired his work and mm-hmm. the fact that he was able to put a new language on stage. I still remain very hopeful as far as David Mamet's concerned, but I have been personally disappointed again and again and again since. Right. So it's...
Maybe it's more that
someone has a sensitivity to a certain artist or an affinity with, I think, which means you're more likely to possibly understand, but then they may change directions. I mean, that's why I'm not friends with any of these people. I didn't even know any of them, really.
Right.
It would just, you know... It's not a personal relationship. On the other hand, one does respond very personally. And if you feel angry, if it's someone you think is really talented, who's let you down, who is sort of, you know, coasting on automatic pilot, I think that's when you do have to pull back and cool off. Mm. I don't think you want to write a splenetic review about that.
Mm. Because you don't want to run the risk of it getting personal, or you just want to make sure that it's a level-headed...
Oh, you want it to be level-headed? You want it to be if someone comes back and says, no, that's not right, that you at least have laid your argument out carefully? Mm. I mean, rage and passion are very dramatic emotions, but they don't really advance a critical argument very well, I don't think.
You just mentioned that, you know, you don't know these people personally.
No.
And I guess there is a question of whether or not critics are considered part of the theater community or whether they are, you know, their own sort of outsiders who are looking in or assessing from the outside. And you said in Matt Winman's book, I don't hang out with theater people. It's not my world.
No.
So it seems you've drawn very clear line in your life. Between...
Yeah, I think that comes from my parents being journalists also, and there was just a certain code of what you could and couldn't do. Women's wear, on the other hand, I mean, everyone was in bed with everyone else, not literally, although in some cases probably literally as well. But it was, you were expected to have lunch with the designers and get gossip from them, and these were the people you might crucify in the pages the next day. So perhaps that thickened my skin. But also that was very much the editor's sensibility. That was John Fairchild. But no, I once went to a dinner for Simon Russell Beale. You've heard this story, right?
I have not. No.
I have not heard it.
This is my party anecdote. A friend of mine, he was doing something with the bridge at BAM. I think it was Vanya and maybe Twelfth Night. And this friend of mine who loves to give dinner parties called me when my review came out and said, oh, thank God you liked it. Can't you come for my dinner for him? And I thought, you know, he's English. I've never said anything bad about him. I mean, how bad can it be? And so I went, and there were, people were gathered in the little, whatever it is, the, cocktail area. And Simon and I were talking politely, and someone said, hey, you guys aren't even supposed to be in the same room, are you? And someone else said, no, it's okay. Didn't Ben say he was the greatest classical actor of his generation? And Simon Russell Beale said, no. He said, perhaps the greatest classical actor of his generation.
There you go.
Well, I think you've just answered our next question, right. Which was, many people know your name, right? Because of who you write for and the longevity of your career. But I think a lot of people don't know who you are. And I don't think you probably get recognized on the street very often. No. I could be wrong about that. And is that all by design?
I mean, do I want to be a brand name all in myself? No. I mean, do I want to market my personality? No. No, I came from a rather private family. And I answer any questions happily, but I lead a boring life. I am kind of protective of my friends, but when everyone you know is an organized crime, you can't talk about it all.
Well, that's very true.
That's very true. Do you find, though, because you're called upon by your profession to bring your critic hat to the media that you consume, do you find that when you're not on assignment, you're able to maybe perhaps approach things without such, the scrutiny or the rigor that you might bring
if I watch something like Knives Out, I'm not going to be, or I just watched the BBC Dracula. Have you seen that?
I hear it's... quite good.
Yeah, it is. It's, do you like Sherlock? It's that sensibility.
Yeah. It's bloody too.
Very bloody. Yeah. But that stuff I can sort of veg out on. Obviously there's a part of you that you're always going to have an opinion. We're just built to have opinions. But it's kind of a relief not to have to be quite so analytical about it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I can let my attention wander, which I would never do if I was reviewing a play, which means that you can't be bored. If you're paying attention, you can't be bored because you're trying to figure out something while you're watching it. So, I can be bored by the third season of The Crown.
I have two questions, actually. Do you have a word count at the Times?
On the budget, saying what's going in, I think Jesse and I are down for like 1,000 words. Sometimes I go over. I think the one tomorrow is 1,065.
And no one's going to call you out on that.
No. And also if it's something like, the inheritance, that's 6 hours of theater. You do need some space to spread out on that. And no one's going to say.
You should be almost allowed 2,000 words for six full hours. Yeah. Well, because you have a deadline.
Yeah.
And so... by virtue of that, there is a time frame in which you have to file your review.
Right.
Do you ever find that you file a review and then you continue to think about a work and then maybe even revisit that work and think, maybe my review didn't fully capture my experience or capture what I wanted to say?
Well, I think it did capture the experience of how I felt about it that night. Whatever I write, it's... Because, I mean, it's not a, what I was saying before, it's not a static work of art. So, and we aren't static people. You're going to see things a little bit differently every time. There are, going back and seeing Caroliner change in this production, it impressed me so much more than it had the first time.
You mean the original production?
Yes. Yeah. With the George C. Wolfe.
Right.
Right. On the other hand, going back to A Bright Room Called Day, I didn't feel like I'd missed something the first time around.
Well, let me ask you this, because there is this real thing in theater that shows get reviewed sort of fairly early on in the process.
Right.
And then they tend to come into their own, 6 months why isn't there a second review, or why doesn't a critic go back and look at something a second time?
Well, I think we would if we had more time. There is so much opening right now, and we have, a wonderful group of stringers of other critics who I think bring a very particular and piquant viewpoint to each of their reviews. But even so, it's tough. We used to more routinely, go back and see how, the musicals were holding up. They usually didn't want us to come.
Stay away. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess it depends on the show.
Right.
But other things, I remember going back and, I've been asked sometimes to go back and see things a second time. There was a production of the Best Man that really had gotten it right further down the line.
Was this the most recent or the one before that?
No, it was the one before
in 2000. Yeah.
Was that that was the Jeffrey Richards production?
It was. Yeah, it was. With Chris Ebersol and a bunch of people.
Chris Ebersol is sort of, not Pat Nixon. She was Jackie Kennedy, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes people do settle into it. And sometimes you can sense there's kind of a nervousness abroad. When you see things in the summer, and I do like to go to some of the various outposts, summer theater outposts, but Williamstown or whatever being the most obvious, you think they had 2 weeks to put this together. And yet sometimes when Sam Rockwell and Nina Arianda did Fool for Love, they stepped into those parts at the last minute. The original cast they bowed out and they were sensational. It was just, and I think they kept that kind of rawness and spontaneity when it came to Broadway. And that was a play no one went to see.
Yeah. I saw it. Yeah. Sometimes the stars align and then everything else doesn't.
Right.
I do think Sam Shepard will ever actually do well on Broadway.
Think he ever will, or you think he'll?
Sorry, I think he'll. It's like Beckett. Do you know?
Yeah.
It's not what Waiting for Godot did open here, and it opened on Broadway, and it got respectable reviews. But basically, the most important playwrights, albeit being an exception, are not necessarily box office.
Well, I guess we've talked now for a good amount and we've covered a lot of ground. But one question that we haven't really talked about is, what is the purpose of theater criticism?
Oh, theater criticism. I love reading criticism. I always have. Sort of tutelary god when I was a kid was Pauline Kael. My parents subscribed to The New Yorker, and I read her most avidly. And I think she's probably had more influence on me than, at least among critics, than anyone else I read. But I did realize early on that my response was not going to be the same as hers. I like to think that I was also a person of taste, but then I thought, no, I don't agree with that. And you shouldn't be ashamed ever of how you react to something unless you've really been had, by systematic button pushing. But I loved reading her. I loved her passion. I loved being able to have the conversation in my head with her, or George Bernard Shaw, or Kenneth Tynan, James Agee, Frank Rich. Those are just, they're fun. They're passionate voices with strong points of view. And if they make you mad, that's good too. You want to make people... part of my job is to provide a window onto theater for people who might not go otherwise, or might not necessarily be tempted to go otherwise, and to recreate that moment historically. But mostly it's for people who like theater, like me, who have their own ideas and want to talk back. And I don't think you have to have that conversation online. I think it can be an internal conversation as well. But that's just the way I grew up reading. I mean, I couldn't imagine myself at 10 going, Pauline Kael, about the use of the blah, blah frame.
Right, right.
Is there, in all your years of reviewing, is there one show that sticks out as being particularly memorable or transcendent more than any other?
Everyone asks me that every time, and it changed. I give it a different answer every time.
So today's answer is?
The Globe Theater production of Twelfth Night with Mark Rylance. I saw it first at the Globe itself, and it's one of those things where I just started crying 5 minutes into it and pretty much didn't stop.
That's the one that came to Broadway.
Yeah. That was magical.
There's something about Candlelight.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. There's something about Candlelight.
None of them looked a day over 30.
Oh my gosh. Well, as we round to the end of our conversation, what is something about being a professional theater critic that most people don't know that you wish they knew?
Oh gosh. I think the less they know, the better.
Okay. Well, there it is.
There it is.
That's fair. Well, we have one final question, and this we ask every single person. Right. And that question is, was there a particular show or moment in your life that made you want to be a part of the theater?
It was probably a Wake Forest College that was then production of My Fair Lady in the Round. I went backstage, and the smell has always been very seductive for me. As you know, I haven't been backstage in so long. I don't know if it smells the same. You know, the hot lights and the grease paint and the sweat, and it does. Yeah.
Well, it's a little more electronic, right, but yes,
right.
It was totally magic to me. It always was. I think I love books for the same reason. Which is just someone saying, I'm going to create a world for you now. And to actually have that taking place before your eyes in the flesh, I mean, I think it appeals. I mean, as a child, it's a great time to fall in love with the theater, because there is something it taps into that is very childlike in the best sense, which is that sense of, tell me a story.
Rob here with You May Be Wondering. To be honest, my head is still spinning from our conversation with New York Times co-chief theater critic Ben Brantley. During that chat, he mentioned Richard Maxwell a couple times. You may be wondering, who is that? Well, Richard Maxwell is an experimental theater director and playwright based in New York, who currently serves as artistic director of the New York City Players, a theater company he founded in 1999, primarily as a platform for his own work, but though the company has also had partnerships with other artists and companies over the years. Born in West Fargo, North Dakota in 1967, Maxwell studied acting at Illinois State University and began his professional career with the Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago. He's also the founder of the Cook County Theater Department in Chicago. In his work as a playwright, Maxwell is known for creating narrative-driven works that incorporate the repetition and artificiality of the theater. I suspect that Ben Brantley had Richard Maxwell on his mind when we spoke, because he had just written a review of Maxwell's latest play, Queen's Row, which consists of three monologues by women set in the aftermath of a civil war in a near-future America. In that review, Brantley calls Maxwell the most complete American theater auteur of his generation. He goes on to report, throughout more than two decades of experimental playmaking, during which Maxwell has become an august presence in international theater, he has aspired to almost Olympian neutrality. His plays have depicted all sorts of archetypes in classically extreme situations, boxers and adulterers, cops and crooks, lonesome cowboys and wandering knights, with an air of deadpan detachment. In recent years, he has focused on mortality, in both a personal and general sense, with works of elegant distillation and subtraction. Brantley goes on, Queen's Row is ultimately a portrait not just of what is lost when a world ends, but of what remains. And he closes his review with the following observations. Ultimately, Queen's Row is a testament to the forms of faith, from the eloquently religious to the more inchoate and instinctive, that allow human beings to endure amid unspeakable loss and privation. That summing up would probably be too sentimental for Maxwell, who carefully resists the cliches of uplift and consolation. It's true that his women are also irrevocably solitary. You feel that they would be devoured by the shadows at any moment. But it's not darkness in which we end the show. Or not unconditional darkness, anyway. The production ends with a sly concluding vision of ineffable beauty, in which slender columns of light slice through the pitch blackness. They're barely perceptible, but they're there. They almost feel like hope. Hopefully that glimpse of Brantley's writing gives you an idea of what makes him such a celebrated theater critic. And hopefully it also piques your own interest to check out a future piece by playwright and director Richard Maxwell.
Jamie here. That's our show. Thanks for listening. You can hear us anytime on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you'd like, please rate us and review us. You can find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman and Charles Van Kirk. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.